What's up, everybody? Long time no see. I know it's been a while since we've released a podcast, but I think we're going to be starting off with a bang. It's just been a crazy few months with summertime, COVID, the own personal business of Capacity PT's brick and mortar business kind of blowing up and getting crazy and adding staff and so forth. It's just been hard to find the time. Plus, it's also been hard to lock down interviews because people are equally busy. But things are going to start picking back up with the one interview a month, one monologue-based discussion podcast a month. We've got an excellent guest on today. We have an upcoming orthopedic surgeon talking about foot-ankle dysfunction. We're going to have monologues or discussion-based podcasts on sports performance, on athletic recovery, on postural assessment and stability. So a lot of fun stuff to come. As always, I appreciate everybody for listening. I appreciate if you can spend the time to leave any sort of reviews to start to spread the word. I also appreciate just the family in general. So I've gotten a lot of great feedback, emails, people asking for more content. So all your reviews and feedback aren't going unheard, and I really appreciate it. So again, well, who we have today is Perry Nicholson. He is formerly a chiropractor, but as you'll pick up from the conversation today, he is way more than just that. When you think of chiropractor, you think someone throwing on your table and popping your T7 or whatever it is. The way he assesses movement, the way he assesses the individual in their entirety is rather groundbreaking from my point of view. And I know maybe controversial in the traditional health and wellness model. Traditional health and wellness model is you image something. If it's torn, you fix it with surgery. If it's not torn, you take a pill or take a shot. And you'll learn from this discussion today that very rarely are those the true answer. And often all the medical interventions we're providing are really just band-aids. We're not getting to the source, with the source often being the foundations of eating, diet, stress, sleep, and recovery. We do talk about that in this podcast, but what we really talk about is both the vagus nerves and lymphatics. The vagus nerve in particular for myself has been an area that's picked up interest, mostly from mentorships of people like Greg Johnson from the IPA, as well as other providers. If you have not been assessing or treating the vagus nerve, listen, you'll learn. There's way more. Take a course. Feel free to reach out with questions. We only had about an hour for this podcast, so time was limited. We spent the first 45 minutes on vagus nerve and kind of squeezed in a little lymphatics, so maybe I'll get them on the horn again down the line and we can get lymphatics a little bit more justice, because the lymphatic system is incredibly powerful in an area we often overlook as well. Please give a listen. Let us know what you think. More fun content to come. And without further ado, here's Perry.
All right, Perry, appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk. I've kind of followed some of your content. I always appreciate your kind of approach and also your willingness to share. So I know the audience today will really get a kick out of the stuff we're talking about. I want to talk about vagus nerve and I want to talk about lymphatics. And those are, I know, two areas you have a vast amount of knowledge and kind of work with and educate on. We could talk, gosh, for days on either of those topics. I don't think we'll do justice for either, but my goal is just to introduce the topic to the audience and at least give some insights. But before we get into all of that, can you introduce yourself to our folks here? Like, where are you at? What's your current practice like? Kind of your pathway to get there?
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, I appreciate you inviting me onto the show. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah, I love lymphatics for sure, and the vagus nerve, they go very well together.
Yeah.
And so just honestly, just having people be aware that those two things actually exist can make a profound difference in changing their lives, because you don't know what you don't know, right? And then exactly, you can open up your mind to explore different ways to work with them. So, as you know, in my mind, we've already checked the win box of yes, just mentioning those two. Because here's what I found is that, you know, when you learn things and you're in this little world that you're in, you have a tendency to think that everybody knows what's in your small little world. And I'm here to tell you that most people have no idea what a vagus nerve is or what it does, even in medicine.
Correct.
And it's even worse with the lymphatics. They're like, lymph what? So thanks for that. And yeah, to answer the question on where I'm at, well, my office is in northern New Jersey in a town called Waldwick, New Jersey. I'm in a gym called Odyssey Athletic Center. My offices have been in fitness centers for about 20 years. One, because that's where I love to be. I've been in bodybuilding and training and fitness since I was 14 years old. So it shaped who I am and how I look at the world. And it just so happens a lot of people who go to the gyms mess themselves up. You know, so you have a lot of injured people here, and you have a lot of people that are trying to improve their quality of life here. So it works out fantastic. And I also learned early on that I hated being in a solitary office building remote somewhere. I felt like I was in quicksand, being smothered. I like to be around the energy, the action, and stuff like that. And it's great for getting clients to just go out on the gym floor and you do your crazy things, or you train and you work out. And it's really, really wonderful, honestly. And it keeps me in shape because I walk the talk. You know,
yes,
so because I walk out my door and I'm like, well, I might as well train today, right? So I have two things that I do here. I initially started off treating people with chiropractic, which is what my degree is in, but that's my starting point, right? I don't really have to tell people that I'm a chiropractor for two reasons. One, as soon as I say that, you automatically have an idea about what I do. And you would be 100% wrong because I probably don't do anything like you've ever seen another chiropractor do. And then you go by your own experience with one or someone that you loved, whether it was good or bad. So I'm automatically really great or I'm awful without anything. Yeah. So I mix a lot of different disciplines over the years, from Eastern medicine to Western medicine. I have like a buffet of whatever I need to do to try to help somebody get better. And my practice has gravitated over the years towards people who have really significant and severe autoimmune disease, chronic pain, that the traditional approaches to trying to help have not helped, or did help for a little while, but didn't last very long. And it fit perfectly into my, I guess you might want to say my mission, because early on when I got out of school, I've always been on a search for, well, one, why are so many human beings suffering in the world that we're in right now? And then why do they keep getting sick, or why does stuff keep coming back, even though we have more technology and more research and more evidence ever before, and we're sicker, we're not healthier, we're going the opposite way. So I know one thing, whatever we're doing, it ain't working very well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like being a detective. I like to figure things out. I don't want to just do the status quo and say, okay, well, this is supposed to work, and if it doesn't work, just keep doing it, or you're going to have to learn to live with it. I don't want to accept that. And so in order to do that, you have to think outside the norm and think crazy, think different. But it's really not crazy. That's just science. That's just exploration. It's asking questions that other people might not have asked yet. And then you typically find some things that you were searching for that were there all along. You just didn't change your lens that you're looking through. Yeah. So I shaped my practice to be the last place you visit, not the first.
I like that. Yeah, well said. Yeah.
And it worked out well for me, because I want you to think about it. So think about it this way. If you knock on my door, the majority of the times you've seen a lot of really wonderful people, had a lot of really wonderful therapies that can and do work for people, but they didn't work for you because maybe you weren't ready for them at the time. Could be. So here's what I'm going to do. That made my job a lot easier because I already know what I'm not going to do, which is what everybody else did.
Yes.
So I'm obligated to think differently and to do things differently. So I kind of jokingly say to people is, you don't necessarily come to see me for what I do. You come to see me for how I think. And then I thought about that a little bit more, is that actually the same thing, because what I do is shaped by how I think. Yeah. Assuming that I'm thinking and I'm not just thinking like other people told me to think. Yes. You follow?
Yes, follow, yeah.
That's a true clinician. A clinician is somebody who is a detective and lives for the thrill of figuring out not what to do, but why you should be doing it. Those are two completely different things.
And that should be a question we're asking everybody is like, okay, what have you done before? Right? I'm not going to repeat what the prior provider did, or, you know, majority of the time, if the glute strength didn't work, they obviously didn't get to the source. You know, you can't just throw strength on top of dysfunction. That's kind of what you're getting at.
Yeah. I mean, you have to step back and think, okay, well, why didn't it take for this person?
Yes.
Was it the wrong time to try to introduce the intervention, which happens a lot? Was I doing too many interventions at the same time? Yeah. Was the person's nervous system ready to accept what I was doing? Maybe it's the right therapy at the wrong time. That's prevalent.
Yeah.
And what I found is two, is one, don't assume that everybody's already done basics and fundamentals when they come in to see me, because most often they haven't, or they've been overlooked or discounted as too simple and irrelevant, because it couldn't be that simple. Otherwise somebody would have found it by now.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Yeah.
It's completely wrong. So I go back to basics and fundamentals, and I can't tell you how many times there's one that was overlooked or discarded. And then here's an interesting thing that I've discovered is that maybe somebody needed to have what they were getting before, but I found two reasons why stuff might not have worked. One, too many things done at one time, hoping something sticks because they're all supposed to be good. So you overwhelm the system and the body's like, I appreciate you wanting to help, but I have no idea what you want me to do with this stuff right now. I can't handle it. Yeah. So it just shuts off, or it goes back to its old patterns of habits and behaviors, which is your life.
Yeah.
Or two, is the order that you're doing the therapies in makes a difference on whether they're going to work or not.
Explain what you mean by that.
I'd be happy to. Great question. So I always say you have three therapies, A, B, C. And if just because you have A, B, C, you figure that no matter what, whatever order you choose to do them in, that they're still A, B, C. No, because you're dealing with what A, B, C does to a living, breathing, physiological human being that has to react to the stimulus that you're giving to.
Yeah.
So the body changes its output based on its input.
Yeah.
So when you change an input, output can be drastically different. One, because of the person that you're dealing with, even though it's the same input, you don't get the same output because it's a different person that has the input. You follow?
Yep.
But also physiology reacts to a stimulus. So let's give you an example. Let me give you an A and a B to make it easier.
Yeah.
So let's say I do therapy A to a person, and then I'm going to do therapy B. So therapy B has to react physiologically after what you did with A. You follow?
Yeah.
So A plus B will give me C, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But if I switch it around and I did B first, and I'll give you an example in a moment. If I did B first and then I did A, you're not going to get C.
Yeah.
Even though they're the same thing, because the physiological response is completely different. So I might get the letter Q after that. So what I mean by that is this, is that I can do, say, like ice and laser therapy. I'm just picking them out of the air.
Yeah.
So I'll ice the skin and then I'm going to do laser. Okay. And then I'm going to get C. I got news for you. If you do laser and then ice, you're not going to get different.
C. Yeah. Yeah.
Because the body is going to react to what you just did. So you have to play around with the order of things. Right? Yeah. Which could be endless. That's the thing that's overwhelming. So how do you know where to go? Well, it's very easy. You just start with one and you see whether it gets better or worse or no change.
Yeah.
And then you adapt from there and you watch and observe the response of the person that you're treating. Because I can tell you, if you come in with a knee problem, not everybody should get the same knee protocol because it's not the same knee.
Correct.
If you're looking at tissue, from an anatomical standpoint, you know, you can't do that because physiology and biology changes based on the human being carrying it around. So I may start with, I got to start somewhere. You follow?
Yeah.
So let me just do this a treatment to A, patient A, and see what the outcome is. And then I'll do the same one to B and go, holy crap, that like really sucked. That didn't work at all. I don't know why. And then you have to step back and now you have to do what you're paid to do, which is think.
Yeah, be the detective. Yeah.
That's what a true clinician, is not somebody who follows protocols. That's not a clinician.
Yeah.
Right? A clinician is somebody who needs to be able to take this information of the human body, of an ecology of systems working together, and be able to change and adapt on the fly based on the moment that you're in, right? And I always tell people, it's kind of like making a recipe. So this is a great analogy. So let's say you want to make a recipe, right? And you have 10 ingredients to make a cake, for instance.
Yeah.
Have you ever noticed that when you make a recipe, they don't tell you just to throw everything in one big bowl and mix it up and throw it in the oven?
True.
They usually tell you, I want you to take ingredients A, B, and C, mix those up in a small bowl over here.
Yeah.
And then I want you to take these and put it in a big bowl over there. And then I want you to mix the two together. And you're like, what the hell's the difference? It's all the same stuff. No, it's not.
Yeah,
it makes a huge difference on whether the cake is going to be flat or whether it's going to be up. Or when I make a cake, you say, that's the best cake I ever had. And somebody else makes the same cake and they say, that's not so good.
Yeah.
So that's the skill of the chef. It's not the ingredients that makes the recipe. It's the person cooking it. That's what physicians and clinicians are.
Yes. And I think what you're hinting at is people do. They try to throw the kitchen sink at issues and hope it sticks and it's just too much, too quick. And often they're trying to do some sexy, fancy thing and they're just skipping the basics of sleep, diet, stress, hydration, all that stuff.
Yeah, those are, I get people who love to learn that take a seminar a week and that's great because you want to learn new techniques, but you still have to always go back and master and make sure that you're checking the boxes of the fundamentals. Because I'm going to tell you right now, in my opinion, if you're stuck and you've hit a plateau, there's a fundamental somewhere that's overlooked. I mean, just in and of itself, you gave big ones. I can't tell you how many people have come in to see me and nobody's asked them, what's your sleep like?
Yeah.
I don't sleep. Well, if you don't fix that, nothing I do in here is going to make any difference at all.
Exactly.
Are you drinking anything? You mean like water? Yeah, that. And then I say, how much? Like a glass. Yeah. And, that's not it. I have to do that because nothing I do is going to work on here because you're going to be dehydrated and then your blood's going to get more viscous and thick. You can't get nutrients into your cells. You can't get rid of waste. You're not going to heal no matter what I do.
Yeah.
I don't care how magical the seminar is that I went to.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to say, what's your nutrition like? What are you eating? I don't eat. Okay. Are you fasting on purpose? Yes or no?
Yeah.
And then I'll say, what's your typical diet look like or schedule? And then they'll go through it. And those are three big guys that come way before my magical soft tissue technique that I'm going to do to you on my table.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm also in a gym setting. I'm a clinic inside a gym. And half the time, the people are going to the 5:30 a.m. class 7 days a week, not sleeping, overtraining, not eating, having a protein shake and calling that a diet. It's, sometimes you have to like coach them and lay out their weeks for them and pull back the reins a little bit, which is always a difficult conversation. But it's important. Yeah. We could keep talking about this forever, but let's start with some of the vagus nerve discussion. So, one of my mentors, his name is Greg Johnson. He's kind of started the Institute of Physical Art. He's a PT, really awesome guy. But it's what I've learned in the process of treating it is just seeing the profound effects on what we just talked about: sleep, stress, chronic pain. One of the measures I'll use is like heart rate variability, just because it gives me some sort of objective tracking on some of the vagus nerve function.
Yeah,
but for someone who has no idea what a vagus nerve is, if you're teaching a class or whatnot, where do you start on maybe describing some of the anatomy, some of the function of the vagus nerve?
Yeah, great question, first of all. So vagus nerve is sort of kind of a little important for sure. all the nerves are, otherwise you wouldn't have them.
True, right? True.
So And the big thing that people need to know is that they all work together. No matter what the name is, no matter where they are, they all talk to each other, you know, even though they have names, and that's one of the, in their different places. So the vagus nerve is, some of the people listening may know what it is, others may not. It's what they call a cranial nerve. And cranial just is a fancy word in medicine that means your head, right? Your skull here, right? And first of all, I need you to remember, anything that comes directly off your brain, that's super duper important.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's cranial nerve number 10. And you've got 12 cranial nerves. You've also got 24. You got 12 on the left and 12 on the right. And the vagus nerve, you have one on the left and one on the right. And it's called the wanderer or the vagabond nerve because it kind of flows everywhere and it influences everything. And I tell people it kind of goes wherever the hell it wants to go. Which it goes down to one of the most neglected areas in the human body in relationship to anything, which is the abdomen.
Yes.
And it's also called the pneumogastric nerve. And pneumo just means lung and gastric is gut. That automatically tells you right there are two big ways that you can stimulate that nerve. through breathing, right? And working with what you eat and food, things like that. So it's really important, that nerve, primarily because they're finding that it controls what we call the inflammatory reflex in the body, inflammation in the body.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need inflammation, first of all, because it gets kind of a bad rap, like cortisol. Cortisol bad, inflammation bad. No, you need those things because it's part of being a human being and the healing process. It's like love. Love can be great, but if you smother me too much, not so much.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're going to have toxic love too. It's the same thing. If too much cortisol, not good. Yeah. Inflammation that comes and doesn't know when to stop or when to leave. That's what's happening in the world today with systemic full body chronic inflammation that's leading to the lifestyle diseases that we have of autoimmune and chronic disease and chronic pain.
Yep.
So it's everywhere. So that nerve should be able to help you get inflamed, do what you need to do, and then back off and then recover. And so you get injured, you get sick, you feel bad, you swell, you get better, and you go back living again, and you're immune, and your nervous system should hopefully learn from it, and you become harder, faster, stronger, longer, and a more resilient, adaptable human that can take on more stress.
Yeah.
It's only when that switch gets upended, and people say, why does that happen? It's a thing called life happens, where you just get overloaded, or, you know, they tell you to relax, but they don't tell you how to relax, or they tell you to, they don't tell you what to do. So you don't know what you don't know. But a lot of it is just like, you know, the stress response is an inflammatory response, and humans get locked in it. We just get stuck in quicksand, and the harder we struggle to get out of it, the more we get pulled back in, which kind of flows back to what we were talking about before, because any of these therapeutic interventions are also stressors on a system that's been under prolonged stress.
Yes.
So it's not able to tolerate a lot because your stress, what we call the stress bucket, your ability to tolerate a lot decreases.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take much to set you off on inflammation or pain or your emotions, right? So that's why people get pain all over the place. It migrates to, today it's in my elbow, tomorrow it's in my foot, and it's all over the place, right? Or I'm an emotional wreck where I'm angry one moment, I'm crying the next moment like this, right? You say hi to somebody and they rip your head off, which is kind of happening in the world today.
True.
And so you have the what they call the sympathetic response, which most people are locked in with fight, flight, freeze, freak out to escape a threat or a predator or something like that. And you should be able to let that go. And humans have a hard time doing that because we have this thing where we tell stories to ourselves and we relive things. So it's a gift, but it's a curse at the same time.
Yeah.
And then you have another part of the nervous system. It's a little more complicated than this, but this is the basics for the webcast and podcast. You have your parasympathetics, which is kind of like the switch that dims the sympathetics, because you need both. You have to have both all the time.
Yes.
And so one is like the dimmer switch. And that system may not work as optimal as it can. The vagus nerve is the driver of that. Mm-hmm. So you're stuck in this, what they call fight, flight, freeze, freak out, survival response all the time. And then you can't go down into this recovery mode through your parasympathetic nervous system that the vagus nerve is a driver of. So your cells have, they're either in this defense mode where they're fighting off the world, or then they're in growth mode.
Yeah.
But they have to make it, they can't do both at the same time. It's like, which one do you want me to do here? And so we're stuck in the defense mode, no time for growth mode. And that means breakdown and deterioration. So the vagus nerve is kind of that master switch to help decrease stress, anxiety, tightness, and tension. And they call that parasympathetic the wine, dine, feed, breed, which means, you know, you relax, you eat, you know, you set the stage for reproduction, you're chillaxing, right?
Yeah.
And then from there, then you should go back up again. And so vagus nerve work is designed to try to help give some stimulation to that, because over time, it loses what they call its tone or its signalization, where it becomes, it's got to send a signal somewhere, but it doesn't send it as efficiently or as optimally or as quick, however you want to kind of describe it, but it's got low tone to a low vagal tone. And so it works, but it's a little slow to show up. So your sympathetics are like, dude, I'm just going to run with this. This is awesome because I don't have this guy telling me what to do.
Yeah.
And so you just don't know that there's another option. So vagal nerve stimulation, which is kind of making its rounds in the world today, like breathing did and is. Yeah. And it just so happens that breathing stimulates your vagus nerve like crazy. Yeah. So that's what we call a double check the win box.
Yeah.
And so it really ties back to what we were saying before, because a lot of these people are not getting better because their nervous system won't allow them to relax.
Yep. Yeah.
And you can't tell them to relax.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
It's too far gone. First of all, it's too cerebral. It's too cortical. That won't work.
Yeah.
Because the vagus nerve is located back in your brainstem, and your brainstem doesn't pay any attention at all to the front of your brain after a certain period of time.
Yep.
Especially when you're low on blood flow from all the stress. And then, so we need to get the nervous system to relax and accept some of the therapies that we're doing. So that's why in my world, some sort of vagus nerve work is easily indicated in most individuals before I do any type of my other therapies, because otherwise my therapies don't work because they, for lack of a better term, they can't get in.
Yes. Yeah. Do you find like musculoskeletal patterns with it, like, I don't know, upper cervical dysfunction, abdominal surgeries, breathing? I mean, we talked about breathing. Do you find like cervical thoracic range of motion losses that correlate with it? What are some patterns that you notice
physically? Yeah, you certainly can, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because so many things can contribute to it just from your own emotional state. But the physiology and your adaptation and your biomechanics that you're adapting to. And then you have to say, well, maybe your biomechanics are because of your emotional state, right? Right.
True. Yeah.
Because it goes both ways, right? You can be depressed and, you know, feel lost, and then you slump in your chair and you round your shoulders forward and you lose your head.
Yeah.
And then your body adapts to that. But you can also sit like that, and then you can start to feel depressed. It goes both ways, right?
Yeah.
So because the vagus nerve exits out of the skull at the top and then comes down your neck to go behind your sternum, down in your abdomen, I typically find a lot of issues at the upper part of the cervical spine at occiput, atlas, and axis, the first three.
Yeah,
because that's where most of your motion in your neck should happen overall.
Yeah.
And one, you can get a lack of motion in one of those joints. I typically find it at occiput atlas.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so when you lose that motion, it can compromise the soft tissue and the stimulation of the vagus nerve as it comes down the neck. But what's also very common is you can have too much motion in the upper cervical, called hypermobility syndrome. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will get too much motion because of it's C1, C2, atlas and axis.
Yep.
And that amount of hypermobility can actually compromise the vagus nerve as it comes out of the head right by the nodus ganglion. And I see that a lot for people who, one, get over-manipulated in the upper cervical. Two, because they may be locked at occiput atlas, and because they're locked there, they move too much at atlas axis.
I'm with you.
So they get the wrong joint manipulated.
Yes.
Or we know that everything's interconnected. So your atlas and axis, your occiput could be locked because you have poor motion and mobility in your ankles or your foot complex, right?
Yes.
So it, top down, above down, bottom up. So you have to kind of look at everything. So that's a big one. Uh-huh. I see it locked up at the collarbone a ton because of people who breathe too much through the chest and the lungs, not enough through the diaphragm. And then they round their shoulders forward and they tighten up, and they typically have a lack of motion and movement in the lymphatic system. It's stagnated or congestion at the, that's where it drains. So they become puffy and swollen above the collarbone, and that compromises the vagus nerve through its outlet into the thoracic cavity. That's a big one. I also see people have very poor motion and mobility in the anterior rib cage. So they're locked at the sternum, and then they're compromised at the vagus nerve as it travels down with the esophagus. And then the other place I find it a lot, of course, is in the abdomen, because one, people have a lot of underlying inflammation in the abdominal complex because of poor nutrition and tightness and autoimmune disease and leaky gut syndrome and overburdened livers. And I mean, I don't think I've seen a healthy gut in my entire life on anybody. And so you've got the underlying inflammation there, but also that's usually the area that has the most tightness and tension because of our postural habits and the cultures that we live in. So we sit a lot, so we slump a lot. We live in posterior pelvic tilt most of the time, which tightens up the rectus abdominis and the oblique muscles. So they tighten and tense the whole cavity here. And then you lose the ability to get good doming and dropping and elevating of the diaphragm when you're breathing. So even if you're trying to do diaphragmatic breathing, if you have some biomechanical restrictive issues and the rib cage or the sternum or the clavicle or the occiput, because those are pressure systems as well. When your body cavity changes, the pressure from your skull to your cervical spine to your thoracic to your lumbar and your pelvis, they're all different pressures. And they're maintained by diaphragms that are there. Most people are familiar with the thoracic dome diaphragm, but they're also held in by tight fascial bands. Otherwise, otherwise you would explode. So those get tightness and tension, and then you get compromised on the ability to breathe. Why does that matter? Because breathing and having the diaphragm move, the diaphragm moves the organs a lot, and it strokes the diaphragm over the esophagus into the stomach and helps give tone to the vagus nerve.
How do you objectify the vagus nerve, or how do you show dysfunction to your clients? Like, are you doing some subjective component to it and tracking it that way? How are you identifying and showing progress when you're working with people in regards to the vagus nerve?
It's a little bit of everything, because you always got objective and subjective. So here's the thing. I jokingly say with people, if you're standing in front of me asking me for help, I already know you have a vagus nerve
problem. I like that.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. I mean, it is what it is. And it's almost like the degree of what it is doesn't really matter to me, because I need to pull the trigger and then see what happens. So you go a lot by symptomatology, of course, which is subjective anyway. Because pain is, I mean, we do pain scales on people, for goodness sakes. That's all subjective. But I have to have a benchmark of someplace to begin. So I go by the symptoms that they present with. That usually lets me know how much their sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system is compromised, also their emotional state. But you can use heart rate variability, which is probably the one to go by, and you can track that. And they have cool things where people can get that on their own now on their their watches and heart rate variability. And I do Eastern medicine a lot, so I also check some pulse points on the wrist, and then also take and have them kind of track a little bit their breathing with their pulse, and then start to notice if they feel their pulse increase a little bit when they inhale, and then decrease a little bit when they exhale, if the rebound of it, the strength of it changes a little bit. Because when you inhale, they're finding that stimulates the sympathetic nervous system more. Yeah. And then when you exhale, you know, that's vagal stimulation for the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic. So one of the hacks they say is just prolong your exhales a little longer than you're doing now. And then that can start to relax you a little bit, slow you down. That's the key, is you got to slow things down a little bit.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. I think some of the things I like to see or are seeing is just change in cervical range of motion, even some neural dynamics when you get the breathing in vagus right. And that's cool because the client can see the change immediately, so they know you're not just full of it. You can see the change and appreciate the change, but some of the art of it is getting your client to see what you're seeing. And, you know, some of those pre-post tests are huge.
I agree.
I think kind of describing where the dysfunctions are, like you just did, and kind of the kinetic chain, is obviously probably where you go in some of your manual techniques. What do you have people leave with? Like, hey, do you give them like a breathing drill to work on? Or what are your some like active cares for restoring breathing and vagus nerve and parasympathetics?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah. So it's kind of cycling back to what I said before, is that sometimes the assignment that they leave with is just the awareness of paying more attention to their breathing in general.
Yeah.
Right. And giving them some stimulation things to do, for instance. Breathing is probably a bigger one because it's the one thing that you have ultimate control over that you didn't even realize you had control over it, right?
Yeah.
And it can have some quick and profound changes for people, which is great. It's not easy to do, though, because people become aware of it, and then they become unaware of it, and then you're like, oh, my God, I forgot to check my breathing. Or, holy cow, I really wasn't breathing. The first thing that I try to do for people is, and this is very important to cycle back to this, is that you can't give them too many things to do.
Yes. Yeah.
Because one, I know human being behavior, they ain't going to do it.
Yep.
And if they do it, they won't do it for long. And you're not going to make lasting changes if you don't change habits and behaviors. And to do that, you have to do little steps every day.
Yeah,
because little things done every day are no longer little. We call those habits and behaviors. They're huge, right? So I need things to become not a routine for people, but almost a ritual in a way. Yeah. So it's I don't want to just tell them what to do. I want them to understand the meaning of why they're doing it. That's different, right?
Yep.
So the first thing that I tell them to do is just leave with today is I want you to pay more attention to breathing in and out through your nose than your mouth. That's it.
Yeah.
Can you do that?
Yeah.
Yes. Perfect. Because I know that that's so high up on the hierarchy that will trickle down to improve everything else. Right. Then what I do is that when I do an exam on somebody, I call it an awareness exam. Because I'm going to pretty much manually touch every almost 99.9% square inch of your body and see if it's tight, if it's tender, if it's painful, if I see signs of what I call neurological cues, where your nervous system reveals to me that it's uncomfortable for some reason that I'm here.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
And I need to document those regions. And then what I'm going to, and so an awareness exam is for you to one, become aware of your whole body because somebody's actually going there and assessing it. Mm-hmm. And then for you to be aware of, which happens all the time, is like, holy cow, doc, I came in to see you for my right shoulder. But when you pressed around my belly button, that hurt more than anything that I've ever felt in my shoulder.
Yeah.
And see, I need them to know that because that to me, in my world, that's more important than the shoulder that you're complaining about.
Exactly.
Right. Because you already know your shoulder hurts. That's easy. you just point to it.
But why does
what
it
I need yeah. to do is, yeah, I mean, that may be where everything just ended up. It doesn't mean that that's where it started. Sometimes it does. I mean, that's when things need to work out really well.
Yeah.
But if it's not there, that's easy when you get down this rabbit.
Yes.
And so I want people to realize that these areas that you really felt a lot of pain on, or where you felt uneasy, those are the ones that I want you to start to pay a little bit more attention to on your own through awareness, which means just kind of rub it, massage it, stimulate it, tape it. I don't really care what the hell you do to it. I just want you to do something to it, because that's bringing the awareness to it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me clarify that. That's bringing the conscious awareness to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, because it's always been an issue for you being painful, but it didn't reach a conscious pain yet.
Yeah.
It's what we call a non-conscious, subconscious pain. Your brain has always known that your navel sucks, that it hurts.
Yeah.
And so what it's done is it's tried to move around it as best it can, so you don't know.
Yeah.
Right?
It's smart.
And when you, brain is really smart. We're the stupid ones. The brain's really, really smart.
Yeah.
And so when you know that its ultimate goal is to try to protect you, and it never does anything by accident or without a reason. And the brain doesn't make an oops-a-daisy, right? I mean, if it makes an oops-a-daisy, it's not on purpose.
Yep.
And then, so what happens is that we get caught in this loop of just chasing after the pain. And when you study the brain and neuroscience, and you realize it depends on the resource that you're looking at, but I've seen it go as high as 90-10.
Yeah.
Where 10% of your behavior, what you're doing during the day, is under your conscious control, especially with movement.
Yeah.
The other 90% is happening in the background without you being aware of it as a subconscious. Because if you were aware of everything, your brain would melt in about 2 seconds because it can't handle it. It's just like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I think about it this way. If I'm trying to change somebody's pain, movement, or behaviors, why in the hell would I concentrate on the 10%?
Yeah.
I'm going to go after the 90%, or I'm going to make more of the 90% fill up into your 10%.
Yeah.
Then you can start to change it. You follow? Yeah. But you don't know what you don't know. So I also know when I put you on my table, and the more places that I push on that you hate my guts on, is that you have more inflammation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the more inflammation you have, cycles back to tell me what? You got a vagus nerve problem.
Yeah. Parasympathetic is working. Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes complete sense. And followed all everything you're saying there. Let's do a little pivot here with like the last little chunk of time. And I know we can't do it justice, but if we briefly kind of talk about the lymphatic system, obviously that's like your drainage system of sorts. What do you think is like a big oversight in the management of the lymphatic system, just that we don't even think it's there? Like, what do you?
Yeah,
you step nobody, back. Yeah,
nobody pays attention to the lymph is sitting there like, what about me? Like, I do a couple of things here too.
Yeah,
you don't only have to look at me when you got cancer. You know,
yes,
you can come check me out for anything.
Yeah.
So I think just overlooking it or not putting it high up in a priority is the biggest thing that I see, which is what I'm trying to do, is just make people more aware of it. Now, it might not be your issue.
True.
But I want you to check it to make sure. You follow?
Yeah.
So I call it like a checklist for a flight. Like, if you want to take off from the ground, the pilot's got to go through a checklist to make sure that it's okay. Yeah. And if it's not okay, you can't fly until we make it okay.
Yeah.
And that's all I want you to do with the lymph. And if you check the lymph and you feel it's good, how do you check it? Well, you press on the lymph nodes on the body and see if they're painful or swollen, right? And if they hurt, that's the first step. Or you have autoimmune disease, chronic fatigue, or swelling and inflammation, and no matter what you do, you can't get better. There's a second sign that it's an issue.
Yeah.
And so the lymphatics are huge. I mean, I honestly could speak for like 5 days straight on this thing because there's so much to it. But the most of the time, let's tell you what it is really fast. The lymphatic system is a significant part, if not the largest part, of your immune system.
Yes.
So it's designed to kill things that you don't want inside of you, which is a lot of toxins that come from the outside world. I don't care what toxin you name, the lymph's going to go after it.
Yes.
Right? And so the more you can get the toxins out of you, the longer you have a chance of living. Yeah. So that's a good one.
Yeah.
Or not feeling so bad.
Yeah.
And it's also a major part of your cardiovascular system. So if you want to have good blood flow and fluid flow, sports performance and recovery, it's not just about pain. It's about vitality.
Yeah.
Right? The lymphatic system needs to work as well because it dumps directly into the venous system of the body.
Yeah.
You in my world, it's impossible to have a cardiovascular issue without having a lymph involvement in some way. It's impossible to have a lymphatic problem issue without a cardiovascular system as well, because they all work together. They're not separate, right? And unfortunately, the only time anybody pays attention to lymph is one, when you've got cancer, because they tell you, you got to be careful because it can travel anywhere in the body through your lymphatic system. So I want you to think about that for a moment. What does that tell you about how vast and how important that system is?
Yes.
Because it goes everywhere.
Yep.
And it can send, this is what I'd be feeling, it can send stuff anywhere it wants. Right? Yeah. And it can end up in another place, not just cancer, but pain.
Yeah.
You follow?
Yeah, yeah.
So that, how many people have had like breast cancer and axillary nodes, and they take out usually a significant amount of lymph in their pectoral region, and then they get what's called lymphedema, which you get increased amount of swelling and inflammation in usually the same side, arm, or appendage.
Yeah.
And then that's because the lymph has a backflow and it can't get out as efficiently. And it's just fluids gather. And you go through lymphatic massage to try to get it out, or the brain has to try to create new pathways through what they call lymphangiogenesis, make new exit routes as best it can. Okay. But they say your cancer from your pec can end up in your hip. It can end up in your pancreas. It can end up in your knee.
Yeah.
Well, then I extrapolated that. I said, why in the hell can't that happen with any other type of inflammatory thing like a cytokine?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or a bacteria.
Yeah.
So that means you can have a lymph node behind your right knee that's blocked that I'm going to tell you can hurt your neck any damn time it wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then nobody's going to look at the lymph node behind your knee because they're going to say, what the hell does that have to do with your neck? And I'm going to be there on your shoulder telling you in your ear everything it's got to do with it. Because the whole body is interconnected. You have to look at the whole loop of everything and not just stop chasing pain. That's what my brand means. It doesn't mean stop treating pain. It means don't chase it, because pain only tells you that you have a problem. It doesn't tell you what it is or where it is. If it was that easy, everybody would be a doctor. Right? And you just do something to where it hurts and everything goes away.
Exactly.
But it doesn't work like that. It works like that maybe with acute care and trauma care. That's where you know, you don't come to see me when your arm's hanging off. You come to see me after you put it back on, right? So you have to know your role here. But the lymphatics, what happens is that because that also gets rid of edema and inflammation. So you have the vagus nerve that is the inflammatory reflex, but then you also have the lymphatic system, which is the foot soldier to help get rid of that stuff. If that's dysfunctional, then you're going to have the inability to get rid of the inflammation.
Yeah.
And when the vagus nerve doesn't work that well, that leads to increased tightness and tension in the body. Tightness and tension.
You're good.
Sorry, somebody was calling. Tightness and tension decreases fluid flow in the body.
Yeah.
Blood flow in, blood flow out, and lymphatic flow. So they feed each other. Right.
Yeah.
So the tightness and tension shuts down the ability for fluid transport. That's big, because guess what? cells don't work if they can't get
fluid. Yeah.
If they can't get fluid.
Yeah.
That I don't care what you do.
Yeah.
So that in my world, I'm trying to look at that process. And that's why I don't like to do isolated treatment. So let me give you an example. I know we're maybe running out of time.
No, you're good.
Let's say that you got a painful left knee that's swollen.
Yep.
I know that the left knee, your body's trying to heal it.
Yep.
And to do that by delivering a vascular supply through oxygen and nutrients from the arterial flow and the capillary flow, right?
Yeah.
And then so the cells can use all that good stuff and try to make new ones or repair old ones. And then it's like, okay, awesome. But now I got all this waste. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
The waste has got to get out, and that gets out through the veins and through the lymph.
Yeah.
Okay. So where do they go? They don't just magically disappear. Where do they go? Well, they got to go out through the lymph, which has got to make its way all the way up to your collarbone.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in your knee, it goes to the left side of your collarbone. Yeah. And it's got to go out through the veins of your body, which means it's got to go out through your abdomen with the lymph. But it's got to circulate its way at some point in time through the liver. So you better make sure your liver works well.
Yeah.
And if those two things are compromised, in my world, I don't care what the hell you do to your knee.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of the knee has to go to my neck and to my heart for the fluid flow. What if it's blocked anywhere in between those two points?
Yeah, you're not going to get the flow. Things are going to get blocked. You're going to start to see mechanical changes, but really they're just because of the lymphatics, not because of a knee issue or whatever the case is.
Yeah. So they may not be completely blocked, but they're going to be blocked maybe 2%. And that 2% over 10 years adds up, Buster.
Yeah.
So then that's what I'm going to do is, okay, well, what's the big place in between your neck and your knee?
Yeah. Abdomen.
The abdomen. And guess what sits there? The largest collection of lymphatics in your entire body. And this big, huge thing they call your aorta.
Yes.
That's there. And that controls blood flow everywhere. And then your vena cava, which controls the waste return back. So if you're blocked there, then everything else along your arms and your legs aren't going to work so well. That's also comes back to the order of things, which means I never, ever, ever treat your knee until I make sure your abdomen is good.
Yeah. And do you struggle sometimes with people understanding that? You know, sometimes the client's like, hey, my knee hurts. Why are you touching my stomach?
No.
That's where the education comes into place.
Well, I'm going to tell you two reasons why.
Yeah.
One, because when I say it like I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's no maybe.
Confidence.
I know it.
Yeah.
But two, I don't have to cross that barrier because who do you see last?
Yeah. Yeah. Back to what we were talking about before. Yeah.
And they're like, okay, doc, that makes sense to me because they've done everything else to my damn knee and it still hurts. I'm like, perfect. Let's rock and roll. And then here's what else I tell them. I say, listen, I may or may not be right. I don't know. The only way I'm going to know is we're going to try it. And I can tell you this much. And I tell them straight out of the gate.
Yeah.
If I don't make a significant change in how much you feel by four visits, there will not be a fifth because I got nothing else in my arsenal.
Yeah.
I can't help you, but I'll send you to somebody else who will. And they'll say, let's do it.
Yeah, exactly. I give the same spiel. Yeah, it shouldn't take 6 months or something like that to see a change. Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
No. And those are the people who I get. I don't know, it's not their fault. It's the system's fault. But they've been seeing a provider for 2 years and pain hasn't changed. And they just keep going and going and doing the same thing over and over. It's like, oh, man, I wish I could have seen you earlier in this process. Time and money is huge. I know we could keep talking forever. It's super interesting. So I appreciate you taking the time. Maybe we'll have to do a part two later to give the lymphatics a little bit more justice. But I learned a bunch. I really appreciate you taking the time. And thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome so much, man. I had a blast. We hit what they call the flow state, which means time just like
flies. Seriously. Hour? Yeah, seriously. Right. It felt like 5 minutes. Awesome. I know the audience will really enjoy it. And we'll have to do it sometime again. All right. Well, take care. Have a good day.
Thank you very much, my friend. I had a good time.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. Our goal is to help individuals like you learn practical knowledge you can apply today.
If you want more information on Capacity Performance Therapy, Capacity EDU, and more services offered by Capacity, go to CapacityPT.com or follow us at Capacity.PT on Instagram and Facebook.